Welcome to episode 31 of Climate Champions, and thank you to James Henry Bedell for the original Climate Champions tunes. I'm Lee Krivat, and each week I publish a new episode with a new climate champion as my guest. We talk about what motivated them to engage in climate change mitigation, what they do to help, and what their vision for the future is. If you or someone you know is a climate champion, please let me know at www.krivatenergyinnovations.com. On episode 31, my guest is Audrey Lee, Vice President of Energy Services at Sunrun, the number one company in residential solar with over 240,000 customers in 22 states and over 1,600 megawatts of deployed solar. Wow! Sunrun has a simple vision, create a planet run by the sun. Audrey has had an exciting career with a BS in applied physics from Caltech, a PhD in electrical engineering from Princeton, a senior economist at the Department of Energy, advisor to the president of the CPUC, where we first met, and VP of Analytics and Design at Advanced Microgrid Solutions prior to coming to Sunrun. It is difficult to find Audrey without her amazing and contagious smile. Whenever I talk to her, I know that she can make any mission she gets her mind set on a reality. She certainly made me believe that Sunrun will create a planet run by the sun. Welcome to Climate Champions. I'm here with Audrey Lee. She's Vice President of Energy Services at Sunrun. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you for being on my podcast.
Thank you, Lee. I'm very happy to be here as well.
Can you talk about the motivating moment for you with regards to climate change? What made you want to do something?
So I actually started my career in physics and electrical engineering. I was working on quantum computing and semiconductor physics.
Really? Awesome.
And I was not happy in the lab. I was all by myself every day. I was aligning lasers in the dark, dealing with liquid helium and giant magnets. But I really yearned to work on something that was more directly relevant to society. And so I started taking public policy courses, actually. And actually, in terms of climate change, I actually started out being more interested in energy. And this was a time when I was in graduate school when politicians were actually changing the term global warming to climate change. There wasn't the same momentum that we have today to try to mitigate global warming. But I saw, you know, energy as a basic need for society. It's something that all of us need. It fuels our economy. And then I saw it as really an avenue to work on climate change by making our energy system much cleaner instead of releasing greenhouse gases into the atmosphere.
Are there personal reasons why you do this?
When I talk to people, a lot of people talk about their children and their grandchildren and the impact on them. I do think about my children, of course, but I think they're going to be fine. They live in a developed country like the U.S., but I really think about the stark contrast of their life with children in developing countries like in Africa. The greenhouse gas emissions that particularly come from developing countries like the U.S. in terms of our energy system are really having the biggest impact in developing countries. Climate change is causing drought and famine and natural disasters, and that really leads to the scarcity and the poverty and really causes the wars, causes the hate and the racism in these countries. And so I think about our lifestyle, the impact that our lifestyle and the energy consumption that we use and how it's coming from fossil fuels and leading to climate change, how that really affects the populations in those more developing countries that don't have the resources to cope with climate change. So my mission really is to make energy production cleaner, starting with in the U.S. You know, I'm really excited that at Sunrun I get to work on this because we're helping customers adopt clean and local energy like rooftop solar, and then the batteries that they offer. So, you know, we can displace electricity that's generated from fossil fuel power plants and help customers use solar energy instead. And then at the same time, help customers reduce their electricity bills.
So you talk so matter-of-factly about the issues climate change is causing. How do you explain to people that don't believe in climate change that it's a real thing?
So if I think about how I would explain climate change to my grandmother, when we burn fossil fuels and release greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere, we're messing with this delicate balance in our atmosphere, our land, our water, our plants, animals, our whole ecosystem. And so the Earth just can't cope with this rapid change that's happening in the environment, and it's unprecedented. That's what's so frightening about it. We don't know exactly what's going to happen. I mean, we have all these models, and our predictions are that it's going to be quite a scary world. And so we really need to take action. And, you know, we're seeing that. We're seeing extreme weather. We're seeing storms on the East Coast, winter storms on the East Coast. We're seeing wildfires in California.
It was just 90 degrees in Alaska.
That is, oh my gosh, that is amazing. And just even more the need, the utilities in California are de-energizing the grid to reduce the risk of wildfire. Our bright boxes are helping customers have backup power during that de-energization. It's amazing in my career to see just how much more certain and how much more the public has understood climate change. It was so frustrating early on when scientists were seeing the impacts of climate change, and it was so difficult to influence the public.
You had mentioned earlier that scientists don't even know what the impacts are going to be or how bad it's going to be. So sometimes people react to that by saying, maybe nothing.
Well, I guess what I meant with that is it could be even worse than what the scientists think. I mean, there's, you know, as a scientist myself, there's an uncertainty range. And there may be a prediction that there is a prediction that climate change will cause more drought and famine and natural disasters. There's an uncertainty range on that. And really what scares me is the more extreme worst case event of that. And that's not a risk that I'm willing to put on future generations.
I agree with you. As a matter of fact, when I used to be in software back in the day, there was a method for estimating, and you estimated how long it would take to write something based on your previous ability to write easy, medium, and hard pieces of code. Uh-huh. And then you would estimate how many of those you would have to write for this particular product to get an idea of how long it would take. But we always put in a contingency for new and changed and for growth contingencies, because you knew what you knew you'd have to do. But things that you worked on never got easier than you thought to code. Some easy ones became medium, some mediums became hard. It always went in that direction. And I think it's similar with climate change. We know the things that are very, very bad that are going to happen based on the science, but we don't know the side effects, and we don't know the surprise issues that are going to make it even worse.
And I think with something like our energy infrastructure, you know, we're making decisions today on what we invest in, what capital we put in, how do we design our electricity grid that we will have to live with for decades to come, right? So it's not just the contingency of today, but it's contingency through time too. And you can't change direction very easily.
Can you talk about what you do at Sunrun?
Absolutely. So I lead energy services at Sunrun, and basically I'm working to close down those fossil fuel power plants, those power plants that are run off of coal and natural gas that lead to climate change. And we do this by partnering with utilities and grid operators, as well as policymakers, as a former policymaker myself. So what we're doing is we're deploying thousands of rooftop solar with batteries, and then we aggregate them into fleets of what's called virtual power plants. So we can capture electricity from the sun on the rooftops of our customers, put some of that in the battery so that you can use that electricity year-round, all day, and night when the sun isn't shining. And then working with the utility, we can provide power to the grid, to customers to the grid, instead of turning on that fossil fuel power plant. An example of this is this summer and last summer, we participated in a demand response program with National Grid in Massachusetts. And so there are transmission constraints also in the electricity grid. And so we're helping them reduce those transmission constraints. They tell us, hey, tomorrow we think it's going to be really hot day, and they're having a heat wave in New York right now. So, if in Massachusetts, it's going to be a really hot day. Everyone's going to be turning on their air conditioner. We can actually switch those batteries that we've installed at homes to provide electricity to those homes, and then a power plant doesn't need to turn on for them.
So you don't look at distributed energy as replacing the grid. You look at it as and.
Definitely for today anyway. You know,
in terms of how
technology costs will decline, I think that will offer many new possibilities. But you know, we have this grid that we need to evolve from a centralized infrastructure to a distributed.
You know, you're always smiling, and I love that. But I made you smile more just now when I said that. I was moderating a panel last year, and somebody from Sunrun was on that panel, and I got them to talk about the percentage of customers that were including energy storage with their solar. Can you give an update on that?
Yeah, we're very excited about customer adoption of Brightbox, our solar and storage product. So We introduced it a few years ago in Hawaii, and where it helps customers store solar electricity so they can use that solar when the sun is not up. And then in California, customers use the solar and storage product to help them shift their energy use from more expensive times to less expensive times, as well as for backup. So with all the de-energization, with the wildfire risk that's happening on the grid, they can use that battery as backup. And so we're at about a 25% adoption rate for batteries in California. That means for all our new sales, 25% of customers opt to add a battery to their solar system. And then in some areas, in Southern California, actually, we're seeing 60% adoption rates.
Wow.
There. And what's really interesting to me as a scientist and engineer is that that is actually less driven by the utility rates and the cost of power, and more by the ability of our salespeople to sell it. And the understanding, it's a new technology for customers. Explaining time of use rates to customers is challenging in itself. And now adding another piece of equipment and explaining how the battery works. And so I think those gains have been in part based on the utility rates, but also in part with training our sales team and explaining this to customers. So there's a real opportunity at the kitchen table when our sales teams sit with our customers to explain energy, how they can produce clean energy and use batteries.
You mentioned Hawaii. Mm-hmm. Are there other markets where they're doing it other than California and Hawaii?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've introduced our Brightbox product also on the East Coast, Massachusetts, in New York, and Florida. And the use case there primarily is for backup, and I mentioned earlier, winter storms, and as well as Puerto Rico, so another island area like Hawaii.
Can you talk more about your prior background, pre-Sunrun?
So I've been at Sunrun for 2 years. Prior to that, I led software technology and algorithms at Advanced Microgrid Solutions. So there, we aggregated a fleet of hundreds of customer-sited storage battery systems at commercial industrial facilities. So these would be office buildings, hotels, water treatment plants, campuses, as well as big box stores. And we were working in partnership with Southern California Edison at that time. The San Onofre nuclear station had closed, and Southern California Edison had a need for capacity. And so working with the utility, we were aggregating those batteries into a virtual power plant, and when the utility saw a need for that power on the grid, we would discharge those batteries and provide that, while at the same time providing benefits for those customers and helping those customers reduce their bills. So I led the algorithms development to manage all of that aggregation. Prior to Advanced Microgrid Solutions, I was actually spent a lot of time in government, where we met.
Yeah.
So I was at the California Public Utilities Commission, where I worked on...
You didn't smile as much back then.
No, really? I really enjoyed my time at the Public Utilities Commission because I got such a great systematic overview of energy in California. And I think the PUC has really shown such leadership, especially coming from Washington, D.C. right before that. It was amazing to me coming to California where I didn't have to convince people that climate change was happening, as opposed to what was happening in Congress at the time. And so coming to California and being able to just move on climate policy was fantastic for me.
You said you came from Washington, so I'm interested in what you did there.
Yeah, so right out of grad school, I joined the Department of Energy as a Presidential Management Fellow. And I actually loved it, because in graduate school, I was working on something so narrow. And to be able to go to the Department of Energy and be told, hey, model the entire U.S. energy system, heck, model the entire global energy system, and tell us how the policies that the administration is considering will play out, what impacts it'll have.
That's very important.
Yeah, it was great to have that responsibility. And so we created these models and modeled global oil flows, modeled biofuels, modeled cap and trade policy, modeled clean energy standards. So it was a great way to take my engineering background and apply it to policy in a very quantitative way to show the effect of certain national policies. Now, those national policies have not come to fruition yet, but I do believe that body of work, you know, has contributed to a lot of the advances that we've made on the state level.
So that was a good segue into challenges, talking about some challenges. So I know that's one. What are other challenges you've had in your career?
There are challenges that I've really been excited to take on is the ability to move from engineering to policy to the private sector to technology development. I think I've been really lucky to have all those opportunities because I
want to say it's very impressive. Very impressive.
Thank you. Because I've always grad school was really challenging for me because it was so narrow, and I really love that systematic view. That's why I love working on the grid, thinking about how do we build a grid that is sustainable and helps us mitigate climate change. But it took a lot of soul searching to make those career changes. I remember when I went from engineering to policy, which is very different. I'm a daughter of Chinese immigrants who wanted me to be either a doctor or an engineer.
Yes.
And so I did a lot of research before making that change and rehearsed my conversation with my father, how I was going to break it to him that I was not going to continue in engineering. But, you know, I came out of that conversation with my father explaining to him the importance of public policy. And at the end, he grew up in Taiwan. He's like, oh, so you could, like, become the president of Taiwan one day. So he saw the importance of that, which made me very happy. The current challenge is we need to change our grid. We need to make it cleaner. You know, California has targets for 100% clean energy, many other states, but we've never done that before. What I'm working on is that customer-sided rooftop solar and storage should be part of that solution, part of that clean solution. You know, as an engineer, it's a non-zero risk because we've never done it before. It's that contingency, as you said. But really, we have no other choice. We cannot continue with our centralized fossil fuel power plant infrastructure if we want to combat climate change. As an example of that, it's been amazing for me to see so many local governments make this change to adopt clean energy.
And they don't really know what they're agreeing to completely, right? Yeah. We know there are going to be issues.
Yeah, let's all work together, right? Yes. Let's all work together to solve
them. But you
them.
Have to have the goal, or you're not going to do anything.
Right. So the one example I wanted to give is Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. Really under the leadership of Mayor Garcetti, they've decided not to repower 3 power plants in the area and have reconfirmed their goal for 100% clean energy. You know, we put out a report that said that you could put rooftop solar and batteries on 75,000 homes in the area, which is actually a small percentage of the homes in the territory, and provide enough peaking capacity to replace one of those power plants. So, you know, we're not saying we're the whole solution, but we can be a large part of that solution and engage the community, especially in urban areas like Los Angeles. You can't, you know, you want to build as much solar out in the desert and wind as you can, but you do have to transmit that into areas, and there are constraints in that. So it does make sense to build more local power to site that clean energy where customers are using it, and you eliminate the need to invest significantly in the delivery of that power.
And who knows what the future will bring.
Right.
What successes are you most proud of?
I have to admit that I'm a very stubborn person, and it's very difficult for me to quit. But, you know, going back, I am really proud about finishing my PhD. And then in that process, you know, as I said, discovering clean energy as a passion, making that career switch, which was very frightening at the time. And, we talked about my career at the Department of Energy. I'm very proud of the clean energy work we did there. I think at the Public Utilities Commission, one of the pieces that I have been amazed how long-lasting my work has been is on data access. So, you know, we wrote a white paper about the sharing of data and making data more accessible to the market while protecting customer privacy. The reason why I think that's so important is that data is really central to solving, you know, our climate change challenges, helping policymakers create the policies that's needed, helping unleash the markets, and then helping technology deploy solutions to these problems. And so, for example, you know, by understanding what a customer's energy usage is throughout the day and the shape of their load curve, so to speak, how they demand more energy in the evening or how solar is impacting that, helps policymakers design the policies to incentivize the behavior, to incentivize technologies to solve that, as well as helps the market create tools to do that, whether it's smart thermostats or smart water heaters or batteries or electric vehicles that interact with the grid. Data, I feel like, is just so central to that. So I'm very proud of the work there. And it's amazing how I continue to get calls from other states. Like, that white paper just lives on the internet and people seem to find it. So I'm very proud of that. What I've been really lucky with is the work that I did at the Department of Energy, where I was using linear programming and optimization to model the U.S. energy system, that I was able to use that at Advanced Microgrid System in the algorithms to optimize battery discharge and for the 50 megawatt project with Southern California Edison. But what I'm really proud of is the scale that we were able to do that. We were one of the first companies to do a virtual power plant. And we were able to do it at a scale of 50 megawatts. 50 megawatts is the size of a peaker plant. So basically, those hundreds of batteries at those customer sites are replacing a fossil fuel peaker plant in an urban area where it is also causing local, where it also could have caused local pollution. So we're helping to clean up the air in those communities as well. And then, you know, coming back to Sunrun, really proud of the work that we're doing here. To throw out another megawatt number, really proud that we won 20 megawatts in the ISO New England capacity market. This was the first time that residential solar and batteries competed head-to-head with fossil fuel power plants in that capacity market. So that'll be about 5,000 Brightbox homes that we'll be delivering in that forward capacity market.
And it's exciting that they're willing to count that and that you can compete against other forms of energy.
Yeah, and it, you know, I have to say, it was an extended process. So we had to go, the winning in the auction was actually the easy part. The work really wasn't going through the qualification process with the grid operator in New England. I mean, they're responsible for the grid. They're responsible for keeping the lights on. And so they really want to know that, you know, will Sunrun actually deliver on that 20 megawatts?
Right, that's what I thought the problem would be.
And so that process has historically been for power plants. Can you build this plant here? Do you have the land? Do you have the permits and the interconnection? And so when it came to using that process for individual homes that will be aggregated together, we really had to create a new process in a way or make alterations to it.
What do you do if it's a cloudy day?
We, in our modeling and our analysis, we actually are fairly conservative. And so the capacity commitment is actually based on, you know, worst case winter low sun condition scenarios.
So does that mean you're basing it on the storage versus the solar?
Yeah, so when we model this, we ensure that the batteries can fill up with enough solar. If it doesn't, then we're bringing additional customers into the aggregation, so make sure that we fulfill that 20 megawatts.
Nice. So what is your vision for the future? We laughed a little bit about whether the grid is needed in the future. So I think you do have some thoughts.
I do. I think back to my DOE day, my Department of Energy days, when we were modeling the U.S. energy system, because we were modeling and projecting the impact of policies out to 2020, 2030, 2050. And what was really surprising to me was we never expected customer-sided batteries to come into play, battery costs would decline so much. So it was actually pretty dire back in the day when we were trying to model policies to mitigate climate change, because at the time we thought these coal plants have already been built and the cost to fuel them is very low and they will always win against renewable energy like solar. And batteries, oh, they're just so expensive. And then fast forward to today where that's not the case. We're seeing, you know, the work of environmental organizations and policymakers to shut down coal plants and set these ambitious climate goals. And then technology being a partner in that and bringing down the cost of renewable energy and storage to make it possible so you can actually run the grid 100% clean. That gives me hope and makes me feel okay being a technology optimist, and that, you know, we need to continue to invest in this area. My vision for the future, especially in the area that I work on customer-sided energy, we'll have a much more dynamic, fluid grid where customers can connect and disconnect, and the grid can handle that. We'll have management systems on the grid to allow that. And I think we get there by partnering between technology companies like Sunrun and the utility. Sunrun cannot continue to just deploy without working with the utility, and the utility cannot continue to, you know, run the grid as it has done for so many decades. We really need to partner on that. Today, our homes can island off the grid, so if there's a power outage, the home can continue running off the solar and the battery. But what if you want to disconnect a substation and island a whole substation? Can those homes share electricity with their neighbors? So can you create this microgrid island at any level, at the home, at the feeder, at the circuit, at the substation, at the regional level? And having that dynamic capability is very exciting to me.
Is that the future you see?
That is the future that I see. But it'll take an immense amount of cooperation, right? Because there's not only the technology and the communications, but also the economics of it. And this is where transactive energy comes in. You know, if I'm sharing my electricity with my neighbor, I want to make sure my neighbor doesn't turn everything on in their house and eat it all up.
And you got to put electric vehicles in there too, right?
And definitely electric vehicles and all the smart home energy devices.
I'm actually giving a talk at TechnoLink in October, and I think I'm calling it the future grid, your home, your car, your neighborhood, the utility, because I think it's a combination of all of those. I want to talk about this exact topic.
Yeah. The question about the future, when I was doing all this future modeling, looking to 2050, I always try to think about how old my children will be. And, you know, 40 years from now, my children will be 49. I have a 9-year-old daughter and a 6-year-old son. And, you know, just how much has changed from generation to generation, from my grandmother to my mother, and as I get older now, kind of seeing those changes. And going back to, you know, when we were talking about my children earlier, just the stark difference between the lives my children will lead in the developed world compared to the developing world, right? How, you know, a child in Africa that faces starvation because of drought caused by, and famine caused by climate change, that's what really gets to me. And even closer to home in impoverished communities in the U.S. So, you know, just across the bay in Oakland, in West Oakland, you know, communities that face a lot of homelessness and children who are facing that homelessness, and how climate change will impact them as well. Really proud yesterday we announced that we have a partnership with East Bay Community Energy to deploy rooftop solar and storage at low-income multifamily homes there. So that'll be across 500 housing units. And then that will help with their capacity. It will help reduce customers' bills in those units. When we think about climate change, I think we have to think about the impact on people who are the least able to deal with it, and how important it is for us to work on this.
Yeah, there's always been differences between the haves and the have-nots. And I think what you're talking about is that it's getting more and more extreme because of technology and weather events. People that have the capability to put solar up and batteries if there are outages. And people that don't have, especially in other countries, don't have that technology, and they have the impacts of the carbon that the haves are producing.
Right, absolutely. They don't have the tools. And so from, you know, my position at Sunrun, I think, you know, it's very important for us to deploy as much rooftop solar and storage as well. But how do we make a bigger impact on the grid and really make sure that we're interacting with the grid to create a cleaner grid and reduce our impact on climate change?
Very exciting. Do you have any questions for me?
I'm sure other people have asked you this already. You know, I love that you're doing this. What have you learned through this process? Because you used to work at a utility, and this is just so different.
Well, when I worked at the utility, I was always trying to innovate, and I was always trying to figure out how to, through grid modernization, accept more renewables and more energy storage. As a matter of fact, I spent a lot of my time at the utility convincing them that we needed more energy storage and we should get into it. I tried to convince them to get into solar before there were other companies doing it. I was not successful. So I've always had the passion, and even early on at SDG&E, I tried to get to Sempra Renewables. But they didn't really have anything for me at the time. There was no distributed energy. I eventually did go to Sempra Renewables.
Yeah.
So I think that I've been following this path. I started out as a technologist here in Silicon Valley, writing software. I have my own software company. I then tried to apply technology and advanced technology to the utility industry.
Right.
And along that journey, I realized that it was so much more important than what was happening in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. I know that sounds weird, but the reward isn't just money or promotions or coming out with a better iPhone. The reward is ensuring that there's power to people and that they can get their jobs done. That was the first aha for me of how important getting energy to people was. But then the realization that it could be renewable, that I could help impact climate change, was huge, and I really wanted to do it. And then Sempra got a little bit less interested in innovation as far as I was concerned. They sold Sempra Renewables, and I wanted to do something about climate change. So I started this podcast and left.
And so in talking to all the different perspectives, you know, talking to all the different people you've interviewed and their different perspectives, does it give you greater hope?
It does. I've learned about some exciting technologies that potentially can help. And that's very exciting. I'm also excited about all the people that are working so hard to help. So there's a big yes, positive factor that I'm getting. I also really like that people are giving up on the question of climate change. Is it there or not?
Finally.
And they're just taking action. Now is the time to take action. And most people in leadership positions understand that. And they're starting to take action. As you said, there's a lot of goals now, and people are starting to move. The negative is I've learned we're already past the point, to some extent, of no big impacts. We're already seeing flooding. We're already seeing fires. We're already having Alaska melting, right? So we're not going to have zero impact here. We are going to have some major impacts over the next 10, 20, 30 years. The question is, how bad is it going to get before we get ahead of it?
We're already eating into that contingency budget.
We're in. Yeah. Is there anything else you want to add?
Just thank you. I mean, it's always a pleasure talking to you, and really happy that we could have this conversation.
Well, I'm going to wrap this up, and I'm going to wrap it up with a wrap. You were studying quantum physics with a lot of notoriety, but you decided instead to help society. Climate change not only closes doors, but it also the reason for a lot of wars. You're always smiling like you're having so much fun, even more now that you're at Sun Run. I'm glad you knew that when you met me, it was at the CPUC. You noticed that electric usage was kind of a mess, so you set the rules for data access. All people everywhere, they all have a dream, but the fact is things are getting much more extreme.
Clean. Things are getting clean, too. Bravo. Bravo. Thank you. I love that. That was awesome.
Audrey's example of how she would talk to her grandmother to explain climate change, that we are messing around with a very delicate balance in our ecosystem for our energy needs, coupled with a sobering discussion on the cause and effect of carbon usage in the U.S. and other developed countries, resulting in war and racism in developing countries, was both moving and motivating. If you have comments or questions about the podcast, visit my website at www.crevatenergyinnovations.com and drop me an email. I would love to hear from you. And if you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars if you're an Apple user, and tell your climate concerned friends about it. And if you're in San Diego and want to trade your concern about climate for a few hours of some great laughs, most weekends I'm doing improv comedy at either the Old Town Improv Company or Finest City Improv or both. Contact me to confirm specific show dates. And if you want a release from some of life's stress or to improve your speaking skills, consider taking a class at an improv workshop in your town. Audrey is the daughter of Chinese immigrants. Her discussion with her father, where she researched and rehearsed telling him about moving from engineering to public policy, and how he understood the importance of public policy, and that she could even be president of Taiwan one day, is inspirational. And while she is not the president of Taiwan yet, she is leading energy services for Sunrun, with plenty of years left to lead a country after she mitigates climate change.